history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this amazing country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are people around you with stories to tell. Maybe you drive by and see their holiday decorations this time of year, but you have no idea what kinds of things they've been through on our behalf. And you never will unless you take a little time to ask and have the patience to listen as they start to open up a bit. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that has been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we're always educated, we're always entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. With the holidays upon us, I thought it was an opportunity for us to pick up a little perspective. As you gather with your family this Christmas, how about pausing just for a moment to consider our men and women in uniform who aren't able to make it home for the holidays because they're answering the call of duty around the globe. During World War II, there were millions of Americans in uniform who found themselves in places on Christmas that they never would have imagined on those childhood mornings waking up early to check their stockings. Often, if we're thinking of Christmas in World War II, the first thing that comes to mind is the Battle of the Bulge, which began December 16, 1944, and lasted well into the new year. Over the years here on Hometown Heroes, we've heard from dozens and dozens of American servicemen who spent their Christmas there in the coldest European winter in decades, participating in a battle that would see more than 20,000 Allied soldiers killed and more than 40,000 wounded. For those who survived the Bulge, every Christmas in the 74 years since brings back those vivid memories. But there are World War II Christmas stories well beyond the Bulge, and we're going to explore three of those today, starting with Joe Goicoechea, who had left Boise, Idaho to work in a remote spot in the Pacific called Wake Island. He wasn't even officially in the military at that point. He was one of 1,100 men working on Wake for the Morrison Knudsen Construction Company when the Japanese attacked 77 years ago.
Well, Honolulu, it was hit at 7:57 in the morning. We were hit 4 hours later at 11, but we was across the international dayline of December the 8th for us. December the 7th on the other side.
But did you hear about what happened at Pearl Harbor before the Japanese hit you?
Well, we heard a few hours before, but we figured we'd have some help. And then we had a Pan American Airways plane in the lagoon, and it took off for Guam or the Philippines. And then pretty soon, half hour or not, they come back and let the gas out and landed. And it wasn't long after that, all hell broke loose. Japs come in from the sun, and they wasn't very high, and they dropped their loads and so forth. And we had 12 fighter planes there, and I think 8 of them were hit. The pilots were in there, too.
And where were you, and how did you witness all this?
Peel Island. We were building a bomb-proof powerhouse. We were just getting ready to get on the truck to go to the mess hall on Wake to eat, and then that's when all hell broke loose.
And for those who aren't familiar with the layout, tell us where Peel Island is in relation to Wake.
We had a bridge there, about 100 meters bridge, that brought Wake with Peel. Then on the other side was Wilkes Island. But they were building a passage for the submarines to come in. So those people had to go by boat across the little channel there to go to Wilkes. But they seen a lot of action, too.
So you think you're taking a lunch break, and all of a sudden you're at war.
Yeah, all hell broke loose. And then we was all confused, and I never did hear what Mr. Teeter said, but I was told that the guys at the camp on Wake by the mess halls, and of course I was on the other island, he told them that everybody was on their own and go out in the brush, and if they needed people, they would come and get them, which they didn't. So I don't know. There was a lot of confusion among our people, to the brains and so forth.
So what was going through your mind? You're 20 years old. You're halfway around the world from any kind of family or anybody that you have a real good relationship with, and now all of a sudden you're on your own against the Japanese.
Well, it was trying to overcome the shock. I tell you, that first day, that night, that was all held. Really shocked, you know, and all, but I leveled out since afterwards, and I volunteered a lot for different things, and in the end, they was going to hold back 300 men. There was 1,165 of our guys. I think around 300 Marines, 68 Navy, 6 Army with a Captain Wilson. They had the communications between the gun positions and so forth. They asked for volunteers. They needed about 300 men to stay with the Marines, and I volunteered to stay. But the guy was over me, Superintendent Iron and everything, he and I didn't hit it off, and we had a few words, and he said, I had a meeting today with the officers, and your name's on there to stay. And I said, I got one better on you. I already volunteered. Yeah.
Why did you volunteer?
At my age, if I went back to States, I'd been inducted into some force, and I don't know where I end up, and I may not even come out alive. So it's just one of those facts in life that you have to say yes or no to and don't have much time to think.
And I think your situation is different from a lot of the veterans that I talked to, because a lot of them were about what your age was at the time. They're 18, 19, 20, but everyone they're serving with is the same age. You had gone over with these contractors, and as you said, a lot of them were older than you. So you have guys twice your age, 40s, 50s, that are fighting next to you, huh?
They were experienced men in their trades and so forth, and being bad times in the country here, a lot of them went over and got made good pay, money, and had good conditions. I was fortunate enough to be in the barracks with some journeymen iron workers and carpenters and so forth, and I had one particular iron worker foreman spend sometimes the evening teach me how to read the plans and so forth, and I carried on the rest of my life doing that.
But for a while, you didn't know if there was going to be a rest of your life. After you volunteered to fight the Japanese there, what kinds of things did you do? Were you on a gun? What were you doing?
No, moving 3-inch guns mostly, anti-aircraft guns. And then when you move the guns, you got to sandbag them. You got to protect them. And you got to have protection for the men because they're not right on the gun all the time. They're away, and then you have jobs of carrying the ammunition. And that's a full-time job, too.
And you got to make sure you don't get hit by the incoming either, right?
You got to be careful. And we suffered a lot of casualties, and I don't know. I was pretty fortunate. The second day, we had hit awful hard. We was on Peel. We just moved some guns from one end of Peel to another end, and we got hit during the day at noon. I was covered with blood. I was evidently knocked out a little bit, and I was laying on a guy, and he says, you're hit. Couldn't feel nothing. I looked over there, and he had a big hole in his back. And I said, Ernie, you're the one that's hit. Then he panicked a little bit. And then to the right of me, about 6 or 8 feet, there's another guy. And he had a bullet right through his head. We had a lot of people around us that was killed or wounded. All we had, we just did what we could to help one another and get along. But the hospital was on the wake right across the lagoon, and it was hit. And they needed help bad. Me and the sergeant, Marine Sergeant Ken Marvin from Gig Harbor, Washington, we went over there. I don't know how in the hell, and he was hit in the head and had a rip in his head, piece of metal there. And we went over there, and a lot of bodies, pieces of body, leg, arm, what have you.
You described this, seeing your friends wounded, seeing your friends killed, seeing pieces of bodies lying left and right. It doesn't sound very encouraging for your own prospects. How did you get through? What did you focus on to get yourself through the next day, the next hour, the next minute?
We had a routine of moving guns, and we had to furnish our own food. We had to find out where the catches were and bring them into our dugouts. And I happened to know where a few of them were, and I had a couple of guys, older journeyman iron workers, go with me. I drove the truck because them Jap bombers and the Zeros that come in. And so I hit a pretty good place, loaded up with canned milk and fish and meat and whatever. So we had a lot of stuff.
You talked about going with Marvin to the hospital. What were the extent of your injuries?
Well, most of mine was my head. I was falling down, dizzy, and bleeding quite a bit from mouth and nose, but I didn't. Well, I had coral hits on me. Coral, the wake is all coral.
Yeah.
And coral is bad as shrapnel.
So a bomb hits the coral sprays everywhere and cuts you to pieces.
And I had a few of those on me and this and that, but after you're so long and you got so much going through your mind, you don't feel a lot of stuff, you know, until you settle down and get your marbles back. And then you go look for some medic or somebody can help you a little bit.
So did you stay in the hospital or did they put you back out there?
No, the hospital was blown, gone. So we had some facilities there we built, concrete bomb shelters and stuff to store ammunition. They used those for hospitals, and they had some underground stuff we dug out with our equipment, heavy equipment, and they used them for hospitals. And we only had two doctors, and we had a doctor with us and a Navy doctor. But we had a lot of medics on our side, and then the Marines had some corpsmen. There's a big difference between a medic and a corpsman. You never want to call a medic a corpsman.
They don't like that very much.
No, because they probably 5 or 6 years becoming one, and a medic might just be 6 or 8 weeks, you know. So anyway, they did a good job taking care of people.
And at the time, you don't know how long this is going to last. You don't know if you're going to win or lose.
We heard, this is all scuttlebutt, this is what we heard from Marines, there was a force coming in from the Hawaiian Islands. It was bringing more airplanes, more Marines, more equipment, more everything. And the admiral in charge of that, I forgot his name, is Pew or Pooh or something like that. He bought 400 or 500 miles away, and he backed out.
That's Admiral Pye, who had a couple carriers, Saratoga and Lexington, headed toward Wake, but called them off because he thought that they might sail into a trap. Some others, like Admiral Bull Halsey, thought that was a big mistake.
He was pretty well teed off at this other guy because he figured it, and he was right. If they come in when that guy could have, they could have brought more reinforcements, got more help, and maybe we could have held off the Japs a little longer.
So you guys ended up, like those on Bataan and Corregidor, as prisoners of the Japanese. But how did that happen? When did you realize that your side was not going to win this battle on Wake Island?
I never did give it that thought. I always figured we'd be evacuated or there'd be more troops come in, more help, you know. December the 8th, we was hit. December the 23rd, we gave in. And we knew around 22nd or 23rd that it was getting close because they said, boy, the ships will be here in 24 hours or something. It never would show up. So after a while, you just gave up on it.
And I'm sure you never had contemplated spending Christmas as a prisoner of war.
They took us to the airport, all of us. They had machine guns around us and all, and we thought, well, this is it, you know. And we wasn't in too good a shape. I wasn't, in a way, and a lot of other guys worse than me. What we were told later, that the Japanese got orders from Tokyo to not to kill us. So then on Christmas Day, 24th or 25th, we all marched to our camp, the good camp that we lived. But it was the barracks and everything. It was hit pretty hard and all, but you could still go in and seek shelter, you know, from the sun and rain and so forth. And that's where we went, and then we went on detail. Japs had us go on details because they wanted to know where those Oki guns were. Oki means big in Japanese. Well, the biggest guns we had is a 5-inch. We told them none, but we went different places and found different things. We found a lot of our dead guys that crawled back in their holes and died. They were wounded, you know. And after a while, in the heat and everything, a man kind of smells a little bit. Boy, I tell you, it's terrible.
I know what happened to you from there. You were a prisoner of war until the end of the war, from the start of the war to the end of the war. If you had known that then, if someone had told you you were going to be held captive for nearly 4 years from that point, would you have believed that you could make it that long in those conditions?
No, I didn't even give it any thought.
Because you have no idea. I mean, this could go on. You could be never get out of a POW situation.
Our mentality was different. We just seemed to be full of cement, just solidified our head was and everything. Hell, and then some of them kind of went a little nutty. And so it takes all kinds of people.
And I know you ended up in four different prisoner of war camps at the hands of the Japanese, and I know there are a lot of stories you can share from that, and I want to hear a few of them, but I'm curious, when you look at that in the big picture, when you look of surviving 44 months as a prisoner of war with very little to eat, not always treated very well, what did you think about that kept you believing you could still have a life after this? Because a lot of guys, as you said, it made them go nuts. They didn't survive. You made it through. Why was that? What was your key?
Attitude. Oh, gosh, I used to joke with the Japanese. We met some good Japanese that didn't have to be good to us. We'd tell them all kinds of stories. They asked me if I was married, and I said, yeah. And rifle. I got two rifles. And another Jap, a few days later, asked me about it and the rifle. And I said, yeah. Yeah, three or four, I tell them different stories. And they wanted to find any kids, and I said, yeah. So one time, about three or four of those Jap soldiers come over there, and ones I talked to at different times in a week or 2 week time, they looked at me and everything, shook their head and said, dummy done, nah, he's crazier than hell.
Finally figured you out, huh?
Yeah, but we, a sense of humor. That's what I feel that kept me alive. I kept going. I prayed a lot. I'm a pretty Christian. I mean, I always did pray. I was taught to pray, and now I did pray. And I feel that's the reason I'm here.
What do you pray in a situation like that?
Gosh, it's hard to tell you. You're praying for yourself, that's for sure.
Get me out of here?
Save me and this and that. And oh, you were scared of being wounded, seriously. That was it, because we had no way. We had two doctors there and the medics, but the hospital was blown up. Everything was taken out to take care of them. Had really no way to really take care of the wounded soldiers, or wounded people, I should say. God, some of them are in bad shape. A lot of them lost a leg or an arm or something.
Four different camps and 44 months as a prisoner. What would you say was the hardest thing to endure? I'm sure you didn't have very good things to eat. I'm sure you lost a lot of weight. But what was the most challenging or most threatening experience that you faced?
Well, so much. In the first year, we was in China, the prison camp there at Wusong. It was cold, icy. We had no clothes. Our feet, gee whiz, just almost cry with the pain in your feet and stuff. And it was miserable. And they gave us two blankets, each prison. You could put the blankets and see through them. Two of you get together. You put a blanket underneath on the deck, wooden deck, and then you put the others over. You never take your clothes off. If you had any other clothes, you put them all on. But that was the first winter in China.
All told, he would spend four Christmases in captivity, finally liberated in 1945 after 44 months as a prisoner of war. He wasn't in the military initially, but after the war, he was officially made a Navy veteran and awarded the Purple Heart. Joe Goicoechea passed away in December 2016 at the age of 95. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, another World War II story to give you a little holiday perspective. A gentleman who spent Christmas 1944 aboard a hospital ship after surviving a deadly typhoon. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.